Okay, our next case is number 20-10786, Karen Slaughter versus the Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service. Mr. Bouchard.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. David Bouchard on behalf of Appellant Karen Slaughter. Had the tax court followed IRS's repeated binding concessions that Ms. Slaughter's only trade or business in 2010 in 2011 was writing, then it would have answered the correct question. How much of Ms. Slaughter's earnings in 2010 and 2011 were derived from her trade or business of writing? That was the correct question because unlike income tax, which Ms. Slaughter already paid the IRS on her royalties from the tax years at issue, self-employment tax only applies to Ms. Slaughter's earnings tied to the quantity or quality of her physical labor of writing. But nearly 4 years after trial, and nearly 4 years after the IRS's repeated formal concessions, the tax court issued its order contradicting the IRS's formal concessions.
And Mr. Bouchard, let me interrupt you for a second. So, to me, at least, the first impression I had about your case was that you were making some pretty substantial arguments. But there's one factual part about the record that I can't wrap my head around. So you say that Ms. Slaughter's trade and business was writing and only writing. And yet for the years in question, she took deductions for things that were unconnected to her writing. So she deducted, for example, the rent that she paid for an apartment in New York where she wasn't writing. And she took other deductions that weren't tied to her, you know, weeks of writing in Georgia each year. So if that's what she's doing and she's engaged in the trade and business of quote unquote writing, how can the writing not include promotional activities to further the writing?
Your Honor, I have three responses to that. First, as outlined in our briefs, the trial record shows that the only evidence introduced as to the reasons for those business deductions that Your Honor is referencing is that they were related to Ms. Slaughter's writing, including, for example, Your Honor, driving to the cabin in Georgia where she writes, or meeting with script writers in New York City in her apartment.
How long did she live in New York City?
She also, Your Honor, she had the New York City apartment throughout the year.
So she deducted the entire rent for the entire year?
Correct, Your Honor, because
you've got a problem convincing me.
Well, Your Honor, let me make two more points there that I think are especially relevant. First, under Christian Legal, the Supreme Court's precedent in 2010, a binding factual agreement between the parties is binding.
I don't disagree with you, but the question is not whether, to me at least, I don't speak for my two colleagues, but for me, I don't have any doubt that the stipulation was a binding factual agreement. But the question is not whether, again, for me, is not whether or not the stipulation was binding, but what the stipulation means.
Your Honor, if I can be heard on that point.
Of course.
I want to just underscore in response to Your Honor's prior question that under Christian Legal, even if there were evidence that contradicted the party's binding formal concession, which, again, we don't believe there is, the record shows that it was primarily related to writing. But even if there were such contradictory evidence and the business deductions were not consistent with her position on appeal, the binding concessions are binding regardless of such contradictory evidence, which again, we don't believe there is any, but there's additional point I want to make there. And that is that Treasury Regulation 1.162-1A provides that a taxpayer is entitled to deduct trade or business expenses related to their trade or business. If that seems like a pretty broad definition, that's my point. That is not a mirror image of 1402A, which provides that only income derived from a trade or business is subject to self-employment tax. So the point I'm making, Your Honors, is that they are not mirror images of each other. You're allowed to deduct more under the Treasury regulation than you are subject to self-employment tax for under the quantity or quality of labor test.
Let me ask you to address something regarding the stipulation. So the government argues that if we were to read the stipulation the way you read it, then there would have basically been no reason to even have a hearing in front of the tax court, that it would, you know, it would just been stipulated away. What do you say about that?
Your Honor, that's a wrong and misguided position. The IRS's position throughout the case, their theory of the case, if you will, was that derived from under 26 USC 1402A means but for. They thought Ms. Slaughter was only in the trade or business of writing, and but for her being in that trade or business, she would not have received these publishing contracts and the income thereunder. But the tax court rejected the but-for test at Doc 64, page 19, and found that the right test is the quantity or quality of Ms. Slaughter's physical labor. That's what derived from means, according to the tax court. And as Your Honors know, the IRS didn't appeal that finding. That's not before the court right now. That is the binding meaning of derived from. And so, Your Honor, Judge Brasher, to fully answer the question, all that IRS was arguing before the tax court was that but for her being in the trade or business of writing, she wouldn't have received the income under these publishing contracts. And I want to draw the court's attention specifically, while there are multiple concessions which were all laid out in briefing, I want to draw the court's attention specifically to the IRS's post-trial brief, which is Doc 50 at page 32. This is especially important for the court's consideration because this was ultimate finding of fact one. In other words, Your Honors, based on all the evidence introduced at trial, based on all of the testimony, and all of the exhibits, the IRS, in a brief signed by two senior IRS attorneys, writes, ultimate finding of fact one, all of Ms. Lauder's income from her publishing contracts was derived from her trade or business of writing. That's unequivocal. There's no caveat, no qualification. As this court knows,
but Mr. Bouchard, you're assuming, I'm sorry, Judge Carnes, go right ahead.
That's all right. Mr. Bouchard, I took the trade of writing, the court's efforts was to determine the scope of what that means. And you're relying so heavily on the stipulation slash agreement, very little on the merits of what the actual dispute is if you didn't have that. And that's what I'm curious about. It seems to me kind of obvious. The trade of writing is actually the trade of selling books you've written. There is no point in just sitting in your cabin and writing. You don't have a trade if nobody buys the books. Her whole purpose, and she spent a great deal of her time, was promoting this, going to New York, going to shows, because if nobody buys her books, she doesn't make a dollar. Do you disagree? You seem to be relying only on a stipulation. If you didn't have this stipulation, how would you dispute an argument that the trade of writing is essentially the trade of selling books one has written?
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, derived from means tied to the physical labor of Ms. Slaughter. And as this court has held in Steffens, the counterpart to SECA, which is self-employment, is FICA, which is the payroll tax that employers apply to the services provided by their employees, the wages that the employee receives. And so the record here is that Ms. Slaughter's labor was writing, and that she had publishers.
Wasn't her labor talking to publishers, and her labor was going to shows in New York, and her labor was doing lots of things. She doesn't make any money, or makes much less money if she doesn't sell books.
Well, Your Honor, most of the money that she received, as the unrebutted record shows, from Ms. Nita Tablieb, an expert in publishing, who's negotiated thousands of author contracts, including with George R. R. Martin, John Grisham, Danielle Steele. She said publishers primarily pay not for the author's labor of writing, but for the author's intangible assets, like the author's name or likeness. Now, obviously, Ms. Slaughter's name and likeness is not physical labor. And that's why the record.
Okay. Let me see. I guess I have the same concern Judge Carnes does, because I just feel like that slicing thing is a little bit thin. I mean, let me give you this hypothetical. Let's say I'm a really fancy lawyer, and I've developed a reputation of being a really great lawyer, and you know, my reputation precedes me. It's incredibly important, and so clients are willing to pay $3,000 an hour for my time because I'm incredibly well known and well respected. And when I show up, you know, people will pay attention to me and listen to me. How would you differentiate the labor that I'm providing as a lawyer versus what the clients are paying because of my sort of reputation and public repute? Like, I don't see the difference there.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would direct the court to Milligan, Jackson, and Newberry, all cases cited in the briefing. And what those cases identify is that when courts apply the quantity or quality of labor test, they distinguish between earnings tied to the taxpayer's labor, which comes straight out of 1402A. It has to be an activity engaged in by the taxpayer. They distinguish between that and actions and activities of others. And so in this case, we have extremely limited evidence that Ms. Slaughter engaged in any activity to promote and brand herself. And what I would encourage Your Honors to do is to look at the Grotzinger case, which establishes that the only basis to find a taxpayer is in a trade or business is if there is evidence of continuous and regular activity. And Ms. Slaughter was prejudiced at trial because she had no need, she thought, based on IRS's concessions, to argue that she wasn't also in the trade or business of promotion, or wasn't also in the trade or business of branding. I mean, there's an endless.
Well, let me ask you a question if I could, because your time is up, but I'm going to take you beyond the time. So let me follow up with a hypothetical that is a little closer to this case. So let's assume that the publisher had formally segmented the payment for the research and writing of a book, along with trips by Ms. Slaughter to bookstores throughout the country and the world to do book signings. Would the income derived from what the publishers paid for her to go to book signings to sign and autograph books that she wrote, would that be money that she had to pay self-employment tax on?
If it were part of her trade or business activity and the evidence showed that she actually did that continuously and regularly.
I'm telling you that that's what she did. So
yes,
does it come within?
If she were actually following through and doing that, then yes.
No, the answer is yes. The hypothetical is, of course she was doing that. The publisher says, I am going to pay you $1 million a year to research and write one book a year. I am also going to pay you $1 million once we publish that book, for you to go to X number of book signings and autograph sessions at bookstores throughout the country and the world, appear in person and sign and autograph your books. Does that $1 million require payment of self-employment tax?
Under that fact pattern, which is different than what we have here, the answer would be yes.
And why is that different than here, if that's promotion for the book?
Because in Your Honor's fact pattern, she's actually doing the promotion, and there's evidence that Your Honor is hypothesizing exists that shows she's continuously and regularly doing that.
But she's continually and regularly promoting in other ways now. It's not just all book signing, but she's doing that continuously and regularly. If not, the publisher wouldn't be paying her for it.
That's not true, Your Honor. The publisher has a sophisticated marketing operation with its own team and an individual who is assigned to Ms. Slaughter to curate, develop a strategy to market her. That's that individual's labor, for which if that individual were an independent contractor, that individual would be subject to self-employment tax. This is not an income tax analysis. It's only whether or not Ms. Slaughter's physical labor produced the earnings. And here, the tie is too tenuous. If the court were to engage in a but-for analysis, then perhaps the answer would be yes, there is a connection. But Ms. Slaughter's physical labor, and to Judge Brasher's question earlier, to the extent that Ms. Slaughter wrote great books in 1999 that became bestsellers because her publishers turned her into a brand author and marketed her, she was already taxed under the self-employment tax provision on her prior writing. And the rule under Milligan, Jackson, and Newberry is not that you continue to be taxed forevermore on any activity that somehow relates back to the original labor that you performed. Milligan holds that very clearly with an insurance agent who sold policies, retired. And then the question was, if he continued to receive commissions after his retirement, based on his book of business from pre-retirement, was it still tied to his labor pre-retirement?
That's not the same. That's not the same, Mr. Bouchard, because in this case, Ms. Slaughter is required to engage in physical activity for the promotion. You just said she traveled to New York City to meet with the publisher and her team and the like. Those are not just royalties being paid for past work.
But those activities, Your Honor, are slight and less than the substantial portion of her intangible assets payments, which the only record evidence is or for her name and likeness. Ms. Nita Taglib testified that approximately 75% of what publishers pay brand authors is for their name and likeness. And Your Honors can look at Ms. Slaughter's writing was excellent in 1999, but she didn't make hardly any money for it because she was unknown. And then publishers entered the picture and worked very hard to make her into a household brand name. Because of their work, her name became a brand name. And now she commands substantial royalties because of the work of the publishers on her behalf.
Let me ask you a question, because this is something I was confused about, and I think I may be understanding your argument better now. But so why does it matter? So you said this several times, the publishers are doing work. There's a team that does this for the publishers. Why does it matter if she's also doing stuff too, right? I don't understand how that's responsive. If she is also, part of her work is supporting herself, going out there, marketing, advertising, you know, running around doing book signings, why does it matter that there's also another team that does that and maybe is even more responsible for that? Why does that matter?
The reason why, Your Honor, is 26 United States Code 1402A, which says that a taxpayer owes self-employment tax on earnings derived from the taxpayer's labor, not the labor of third parties, not circumstances outside of their control. And that's why Milligan is helpful and persuasive here, because the publisher's labor and activity is what created the brand that Ms. Slaughter now benefits from. Her writing is the same quality as it was in 1999, and there's no record evidence to the contrary.
See, that's very odd. I mean, you may be right about that. I guess that just seems odd to me, because you're suggesting that the publisher is paying her money for something that the publisher has done, which just seems like a very odd economic transaction.
Well, but it's not, because Ms. Slaughter has a personal right to her name and likeness. And in order to get consideration that is valuable in exchange for her name and likeness being put on the sides of city buses and billboards and losing her anonymity and privacy, essentially, she is entitled to substantial consideration, which is what she received. We're not arguing that she doesn't write great books. She's obviously a
fantastic. Yeah, she would probably fire you if you were arguing that. I wouldn't suspect.
I agree. I agree. But the point is that as Ms. Taglib testified, just as John Grisham and George R. R. Martin and the other brand name authors out there also write quality books, it's their name that distinguishes them from David Bouchard, who, if I wrote the same book, it wouldn't go anywhere. And it's the publisher's labor that produces that difference, which is borne out.
Let me ask you, Mr. Bouchard, does it affect your argument at all that not just the publisher was promoting her books, not just she was personally going to signings and such, but that her agent was continuously working to promote her books? How does that factor into your analysis?
Thank you, Your Honor. That doesn't change it because the IRS never made that argument below. And so it's not before this court. It was an argument that if the IRS had made, then Ms. Slaughter would have introduced evidence in response to it. But there's another problem with that argument. And that is, again, back to Judge Brasher's question about why does the publisher's labor not apply back to Ms. Slaughter? And that's because 1402 says self-employment tax only applies to the taxpayer's labor, not to the labor of other third parties like the agent. The agent would be subject to self-employment tax for her own labor. Your Honors, if there's no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
You've saved all of your time for rebuttal, Mr. Bouchard. We took you over, so you've got all of that time left.
Thank you.
Hey, Ms. Wong.
You're muted, Ms. Wong.
I'm sorry. Good morning again. Cheryl Wong for the commissioner, and may I please report.
Could you speak louder?
Yes, I will do my best.
Or raise the volume on your computer. That might work a little too.
Okay. The goal of Ms. Lawler's business is to sell books. All her publishing income is derived from that one unitary business, which the tax court found, as a matter of fact, included writing, branding, and contracts that she negotiated for and agreed to in her contract. That is worth reviewing between her, and we absolutely did not stipulate to what.
I can't hear you very well. Can you all hear her?
Very lightly.
Okay.
I'll put up, let me see. I'm going to put up my volume and see if that helps with yours.
Sometimes it helps. Unfortunately, sometimes it helps if you put your face really close to the microphone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this any better, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. It's a little better. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Which the tax court found, as a matter of fact, included not just the physical writing of the book, but the branding and the promotion, as well as the clauses that she agreed to as part of her contract. And we absolutely did not stipulate to Ms. Lawler's conception of her writing business. This was an argument that the tax court also rejected in the motion for reconsideration and which is reviewed for the abuse of discretion. Therefore, all her publishing income is subject to self-employment.
Now, Ms. Wong, let me ask you a procedural question, and yes, it may or may not affect the result in this case, but according to Ms. Slaughter's brief, and I haven't read the tax court trial record yet, so that's why I'm asking you this question. Ms. Slaughter says that the IRS did not present any evidence whatsoever at the trial before the tax court. Is that correct?
About promotion?
No, about anything, any affirmative evidence.
Well, that is not true because we, in our pretrial memo, we reserved the right to call any of Ms. Lawler's witnesses, and we did question her witnesses on direct. So yes, we did present evidence. We just
didn't. You mean you cross-examined them when they were called by Ms. Slaughter, or you called them yourself in your case?
We called them ourselves.
Okay. Okay, we'll check. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. The whole dispute is about the scope of Ms. Lawler's business. Did it include just the physical writing of the books, or did it include the branding and the contractual clauses? Both parties knew this. Her trial counsel said in his opening statement that Ms. Lawler writes books, she doesn't sell them, she doesn't publish them, she doesn't advertise them. And that's against the IRS saying in our pretrial memo, well, that conception of the writing business is dubiously narrow. That is the dispute. And the IRS counsel also said in his opening statement that they did not understand how these purported non-writing rights can be described as non-writing. So, and Ms. Lawler put on quite a bit of evidence quite a bit of effort putting on evidence showing that, well, trying to show at least that she did not market, she did not sell. All she did was to write the book. And the task force simply did not agree with her on the taxation.
So what do you say about, what do you say about Mr. Bouchard's response to my question about this was really the standard? It was like there was some dispute about the but for versus derived from, and that was really what the whole thing was about.
Well, according to my understanding of the tax court opinion and also our arguments below, we did not argue for a but for. We substituted for language which is derived by or from. And when you think about it, it's really a matter of degree. A but for test is calls for a much more tenuous relationship. But here we have to modify the quality of labor. Our argument is that, and that Ms. Lawler's income was derived from her labor of writing.
And Ms. Wong, do you think that the analysis in this case governs the analysis in every other self-employment scenario where promotion and branding are involved? Think of an athlete who, in signing for a sneaker or tennis shoe contract, also assigns his or her likeness, so that the Nike or Adidas or Puma can market and brand the product with the person's name, image, and likeness. Is this a test that governs all of those relationships, or is it industry dependent? Is writing different than playing basketball and selling sneakers? How does that work?
It's fact dependent. In your hypothetical, Your Honor, it's quite different because those athletes would be selling somebody else's product, would be using their name and likeness to sell someone else's product. And it's essentially an endorsement / advertising business. And the scenario that you described would be the golfer cases that the parties discussed in this case, Garcia and Goosen. Which is unlike Ms. Lawler's case, where she is writing her books, she's selling her own. That is the whole point of her business.
So if she had given her likeness to like a video game or something, some kind of like detective video game, that you wouldn't be making the same argument.
She would have a better argument that she's helping a third party sell video games. Now, if I may extend your metaphor, your hypothetical. If it's derived from her books, if the video game is based on her books, then the factual scenario would also be, a little murkier. But here we have a very simple case. It's very easy to say that she wrote the book, she promoted the book, and there is absolutely evidence here for her promotion. It's, of course, as Judge Jordan observed, she took the deductions, line item deductions for promotion and her rent in New York City, etc. It's also in her petition, paragraph 6Q and 12N and O, where she described very clearly that in the years at issue, she used the apartment, the New York City apartment, to pay at the marketing conferences with her publishers. As far as the agent's work, there are actually two circuit cases, both from the 8th Circuit and Century States from the 7th Circuit that we cited, saying that the work of the agent can be imputed for self-employment tax purposes to the principal, which is the father in that case. We absolutely cannot waive that argument because we're the appellee, and we can't waive it. We can make any argument that was supported by the record. And I also want to mention two cases that are binding on the court, Stanton from the 05th Circuit and Stephens. And Stanton says that a trade of business, one can have a trade of business by extensive work over a number of years, which is Ms. Lawler's case. She's been really successful as a brand author for many, many years. And Stephens says that you only need to put in as much work as you need for that particular trade of business. And again, Ms. Lawler has
put in enough work to make her very successful. And I'll just step back from that again. It really almost doesn't matter whether she's promoted or not, because it's one single business. It's like saying, well, a lawyer spends 80% of their time writing their brief and 20% of their time on oral argument, versus a lawyer who spends all their time writing their brief and spends 15 minutes at the podium, and that's all the time they spend on their oral argument. It doesn't matter. It doesn't mean they have a brief writing business or oral argument business. It's one lawyer in business with one goal of winning cases. And in Ms. Lawler's case, her goal is to sell as many books as possible. Her advance, she gets paid as much because she sells books really well. Her brand is baked into the price that her publishers are willing to pay for her. I want to clarify something that Mr. Bouchard said about the quantity of quality. This court in Peterson in footnote 42 has said that test is limited to its context, which is a post-retirement payment to insurance agents. And that's not Ms. Lawler's case. Ms. Lawler was paid for when she was working, writing, and promoting her books. So that doesn't quite apply. And Ms. Bouchard also emphasized this phrase, physical labor. That is not in the reg or the statute. The word is activity, and in the reg is service or other acts. So it's not physical labor. And just one very quick word on allocation issue. There is no allocation necessary because it is one single business. And Ms. Lawler's expert methodology is reviewable because there are no objective facts for the court to review the reasonableness of her conclusion and methodology. So in conclusion, Ms. Lawler had one business, writing, which included promoting her writing, and all the terms that she bargained for and agreed to in her publishing contract. We have always maintained that position, and we did not stipulate to another position. Therefore, all her publishing income was derived from her work as a writer, which is all subject to the Self-Employment Act. Unless the court has further questions, we would ask the court to confirm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wong. Mr. Bouchard?
Yes, Your Honors, I wanted to touch on two points. First, in regards to whether or not the binding formal concession the IRS made were ambiguous, as Judge, you asked previously, I want to note that if there were any ambiguity, Ms. Slaughter's interpretation and opinion as to the meaning of that provision or of that concession is reasonable. And because the IRS drafted in its post-trial briefs and said in its opening statement repeatedly the same thing without caveat or qualification, to the extent there is any ambiguity, it should be construed against the IRS because Ms. Slaughter's interpretation is a reasonable one.
Mr. Bouchard, let me ask you a question about the stipulation because I think it's a big part of your case. It's one thing to say that the IRS is stuck with the stipulation as a factual matter, but why are we or the tax court as judicial bodies bound by the legal effect or the legal scope of that factual stipulation?
Because it's a fact agreement, Your Honor, it is binding and the tax court didn't have discretion to discard it or disregard it. They had to enforce it. If the question is—
But the question is what it means.
If that's the question, you think
it means the case. I mean, with that stipulation, you should have won the case with no other evidence presented, right?
No, because the IRS could have tried to ask Ms. Slaughter, tell us about how often and how regularly and how frequently you engaged in promotional activity. Tell us about how often and how regularly and how frequently you engaged in branding activity to try to prove their burden under Brodsinger of continuous and regular activity. They could have introduced that evidence.
So the stipulation is not the end all be all then.
Well, the reason why is because if they had done that, Your Honor, then they presumably would have said in their post-trial briefs, based on the evidence at trial, we stand corrected. She's not just in the trade or business of writing. She's also in the trade or business of branding and promotion, as the trial evidence shows.
I think that's just a very, very fine way to try to figure out what that stipulation means. I mean, people stipulate the facts all the time in litigation, but the breadth of that stipulation, the legal effect of that stipulation, is not for the parties to decide, generally speaking.
Your Honor, I would direct the court to one case, Crevera, from this circuit, which asked whether the party's binding concession was well considered. And I would also direct this court to Lankow, a case that's not cited in the briefs, from the 11th Circuit, 353 Federal Appendix 244, which says, quote, before agreeing to a stipulation, a litigant has a duty to satisfy himself concerning the matters which his opponent proposes for stipulation. The IRS had a duty to consider the matters. It had two senior attorneys on this case, both wrote and signed their names without caveat or qualification that Ms. Slaughter's only trade or business was writing. But the last point that I wanted to make, if Your Honors would permit me to go a bit over.
Go ahead, you've got a minute.
Was that the only record evidence is that Ms. Slaughter engaged in sporadic and occasional branding and promotion activity. As a matter of law, sporadic activity does not make trade or business activity. Grotzinger does not define trade or business. The Supreme Court case Grotzinger does not define trade or business as the dictionary definition of the terms. The Sixth Circuit in 2018 in pension funds interpreted Grotzinger and said, just like Grotzinger says, trade or business has a narrow meaning specific to tax law. Based on the deficient record evidence, there was no legal basis for the tax court to conclude that Ms. Slaughter was in the trade or business of branding and promotion. At most, the record showed she sporadically engaged in those activities. Therefore, this court should reverse and rely on the unrebutted expert testimony that only a fraction of Ms. Slaughter's earnings were tied to the quality and quantity of her labor of writing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bouchard. Thank you very much, Ms. Wong.